Thank you for asking me. I find that it always helps to remember when. It's one of my best tools that I have in recovery, because no matter what's going on in my life, good, bad, or otherwise, a drink will never fix it, and it will only make it worse. And it's the one thing that this brain will forget. So I need to have reminders of what I'm doing here, and that's good, because otherwise I think the problems I'm having today are my problems. So anyways, I am Mary Susan. I'm an alcoholic. I'm wicked grateful to be sober and this side of the daisies. I have not always felt that way. I think since I was 11 years old, I romanticized death because, well, I'll just tell you what happened. My best friend was my dog. I was always, and still am, very introverted, very much an isolator. And my dog was who I liked hanging around with. And I was always outside with him, and I couldn't go anywhere that that dog didn't go. In fact, he walked to school with me, and he'd sit right where I left him, and he would not leave watching where I disappeared in that door. The entire time when I come out of school, he was right there for me. And when I was 11, he got hit by the milkman coming down the road, and I was getting ready for school, and I looked out the window, and I saw the milkman walking down the road with my dog in his arms. And him and my mother buried the dog out in the yard. And my grandmother was still alive at the time. I know today she was my great grandmother, but at the time I thought she was my grandmother. And she was my other friend. When life got hard, I'd go upstairs with Nana, and she would make me some chicken and dumplings, you know, fresh right from the thing. She'd have me help her, or she'd sit me up on the bed and she would read to me. And she was, her bed was always surrounded by books. My bed's still surrounded by books. It's a piece of my Nana. I grew up loving the smell of old leather books. Because of it, it was the only comfort and solace I had. And I was not abused in my family. Physically, I was well taken care of. But there were things that were wrong. Things that were going on that affected me all my life. It didn't make me an alcoholic, but it certainly changed the way I thought and felt about things and drove me further inside of myself. And I know today what I believe, looking at my history and the way alcohol affected me, is that I was born with a metabolic disorder called alcoholism. My body does not burn alcoholic the way other people's bodies do. I'm not able to get it out of my body, and it burns very slowly. So I get very drunk very fast. But it also does is it wipes out my ability to reason. And that doesn't happen to everybody. I had friends that drank and functioned and could see what was going on in life. And at some point in time in their life, they decided that drinking alcohol was getting in the way of them having a life, and they were able to put it down or moderate it or do whatever you do to get off the sauce. But that would not happen to me. From the get-go, when I wasn't even drinking for effect. I know a lot of friends that did start out that way. When I drank it, it was kind of like, just before the meeting, people were talking about brownies and covered with cookie dough. If I had a brownie covered with cookie dough, they don't have enough brownies and cookie dough out there. I'd have to seek them, hunt them down. And I would not metabolize that right in my body either. I know today I'm insulin resistant. I understand a little bit more today. I wish I had that understanding when I was younger, but they didn't know what they didn't know. And it affected me. My parents would bring me to what they call pediatricians today. We take them for granted, all kids go to pediatricians. But I'm 73. And back in the day, when I was a kid, it was very expensive to go to a specialist, and a pediatrician was considered a specialist. So for my family to save up and bring me to a pediatrician, it had to be a big deal. And the reason they brought me was there seemed to be something wrong with me. Well, that's the way it was forever. There was always something wrong with me. And I believed them. I just didn't know what it was, and I didn't know how to fix it, and neither did they. In school, I was not outgoing. I was the same way that I was with my dog. I was the kind of person that would sit there. My test would be done, and if we had a test in a few minutes, because I was a reader, so I could do well in school, and I'd end up trying to help everybody else answer their test. And I'd end up getting in trouble because I'd be giving the answers away. But I, right from the start, felt bad if anybody felt the way I felt. And I didn't. And I thought, well, I got to help them. I got to take that away from them. You know, I got to fix that. So I would just give them the answers. And they used to tell my mother that, who I found out later in life is really my grandmother. They used to tell her that I could do very well in school if I could learn how to mind my own business. And what they meant, I wasn't even asking people questions. I'm still not a question person. I could know you for a year and not know what you do, because I wouldn't even think to say, oh, what do you do for a living? It doesn't occur to me. I've never wanted to ask a question because it put the light on me. It put the heat on me. It had people would look at me, and I hated being looked at. I just wanted to disappear from it for as long as I can remember. I did not want to be seen. And that's the way I was. I out in the schoolyard, when they would be picking people to play kickball, I would go way far to the background because I did not want anybody to pick me, because I'd end up having to get out there in front of people. Part of that, I think, had to do with some of my issues outside of alcoholism, which certainly contributed to my downfall. But I never had a proper body image. I look back at pictures of me when I was young, and I was a toothpick. I was so thin that I had like sunken eyes. I believe today, looking back at it, that I was anorexic from the beginning, that I didn't want to eat food. I didn't like the feeling of it. And I would exercise or be out on my bike or whatever I could do to move my body excessively. So I know today, knowing who and what I am, that I suffered very young with anorexia. And it might have had something to do with that dog dying, that I didn't want to eat anymore. Because this is the story they told me, that God took my dog. And a week later, he took my Nana. And so they told me that Nana and my dog were together in heaven somewhere. And I thought to myself, I hate them. They left me here. Why didn't they take me with them? And I would feel that way right up until Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, why am I still here? Why am I still here? What is the reason I'm even here? So I was not normal by a long shot. But because I was quiet outside of my immediate family, you wouldn't be bothered by me. I was just there. I was just a fixture. And I wanted it that way. When I drank, the first time I drank, it was like I came to life. Like all of a sudden, everything filled out for me. And it seemed so great. We were drinking outside. I think that might have been part of it, because we were outdoors. We were in the woods behind the school. It was the high school. And I was with people, and it was okay to be me. It was okay to be there with these people. And I had a purpose. I had a reason for standing there that was okay. And I started laughing and lightening up. And that I know today that fellowship that I had that with other people that drank, I had the transmission line and it was okay to be me around other alcoholics and I didn't even know why. And it was incredible to me. And I would seek that feeling over and over again. And for a while I had it. I had that magic until the magic turned tragic. And I didn't want to have that feeling. And guess what? I couldn't stop. I couldn't just because I wanted to not drink anymore, or I didn't want to be in the situation I was in, or I wanted to have my wits about me, whatever it was that made me not want to be totally inebriated, I wouldn't be able to do it. I had no stop button. And I would have really good reason. Later on in life, I was in a very abusive marriage, and I would have reason to keep my wits about me in order to save my life. And so I couldn't drink around him because I knew if I drank, I would lose total control of the situation, and whatever happened to me would be bad, and I would not be able to stop it. And so I learned how to, I call it binge drinking. I just learned how to control when I drank, but I couldn't control how much I drank. And so once I got out of the house and got safely away from him, and I was with people that I could drink with, all bets were off. And I followed, I would take a drink, the drink would take a drink, and then the drink would take my life to wherever it took it. And I would not be able to stop that train. I wouldn't even care. I lost the ability to have that because I was so inebriated and we did other things. Of course, you know, back in the 60s, we did hallucinogenics. So you take the alcohol, the hallucinogenics. It took me a little while to get into the pot, but I finally did, and the hashies. And the Magical Mystery Tour, and we had the best music of any generation ever, and I got lost in it, and I loved it. I didn't want to have to come out of that. And we had Timothy Leary at the time out in the East Coast, and the whole thing of drop out and get out of the establishment, get away from the establishment, it was perfect timing for me. It gave permission to me to be the way that I was. Now, I would swear everybody else was doing the same thing, but they weren't. And I found out later in life that quite a few of my friends just dropped out of that scene, went back to work, went back to the establishment, did the things they needed to do to put a life together, and today have the benefits of that. And I got lost, and I was lost like for a long time. I would come back in and try to do some normal things, like I found out I was married, you know, and I was married to my best friend actually from my high school years, but he went to Vietnam, and we weren't gonna get married when he got back because he was so messed up from Nam, but then we did because who knows what we were on, but we did. And then we kind of woke up and found out we were married to each other. And then we found out we had a kid, and neither one of us could put a life together, but his was dangerous. And I suppose mine was too, but we didn't view it that way, you know, getting high, getting drunk, being out for days. You know, we didn't view it that way, but he would not know where he was. He'd think he was still in Nam. And so one day he said to me, we're going to have to get a divorce because I'm too afraid of what I'm going to do to you and to our baby, to our son. And I understood that and I knew he meant it. And I suppose we loved each other in the way that you could love back then. And I said, okay, and we remained best friends, but we couldn't live together. And we did eventually drift away from each other, mostly me, because without that, my mother would be taking care of my child whenever I got to get out with my friends. And that's what I would do. I end up a barroom drinker because that was the next thing. I stepped out of the 60s right into the barroom scene. And from that, I fell in love with that, with the lights and the darkness. It was like, wow, I just went home. Like, wow, I found home. I can sit in the dark and I can watch everybody and be a people watcher, which I absolutely love watching what people did. And I could sit in the background and I could drink and nobody would bother me. And they'd leave me alone. And I could watch my friends make idiots out of themselves. And yet here I was just as much an idiot. I was totally inebriated, unable to get off the chair, the stool, to go to the bathroom. And between that and the pot, forget it. There was nothing going on. And I did not grow up in a home where this was okay. My people, every one of them, there is no other alcoholic or drug addict or mentally ill person in that family. I stood out like a freaking sore thumb. And my mother would just say the rosary beads and cry over me. And my father just absolutely wanted nothing to do with me because I was making my mother cry and pray. And anyway, so I just stayed away. And I wasn't one to show up at the family and cause any trouble. I just disappeared. That was me. I was a disappearer. I would disappear. And people would worry where I was and what was happening to me. And I would just make some story up. I was telling my mother I was doing this and that. I wasn't doing anything. I was drinking. And, you know, I don't know, like that marriage lasted. The second marriage, I found the guy in a barroom. And my girlfriends thought he was cute. And he liked to dance. And I wasn't one to want to get up and dance, so I'd have him dance with my friends. And I would sit there, and I thought that was great, to sit there at the bar and drink and watch him dance with my girlfriends. And everybody just loved him to pieces. And he liked my little boy. My little boy was a year old, and my mother and father, my father never liked him, but he would never say anything. He'd just kind of stand back and grimace. But my mother adored him. But my mother liked anybody that was a stray animal, that was like a foster kid, because she boarded kids all her life. And anybody that had a hard story, my mother would just take you right under her wing. So he was in, and we got married, I think, 3 or 4 months after we met. And it was bonded totally in alcohol. Unfortunately, he got alcohol psychosis when he drank, and he was brutal. And he would think that I was not his wife. He would want me to get out of the house before his wife got home, and he would beat me to make me leave, or he'd do horrible things to me, set my hair on fire, do all kinds of crazy ass things. And if the landlord came up because there was a ruckus, he'd beat the landlord. The cops would come and beat him. And this is how my children were living. And my daughter was born multiply birth defective. And she gave me an escape from all of it. What I would do is I would go to all the medical things that I could go to for her. I believe that the medical profession kept me alive, because they gave me a way to not drink without even talking about it with me, just trying to keep her alive. I would hide out at the hospital with her so my husband couldn't hurt me. They barred him from the hospital. It just kind of worked for me. And I end up not having anything in me for quite a long periods of time, not years, we're talking months. And it would allow my brain to wake up, and I'd realize I was intelligent, and I would learn everything I could possibly learn about spina bifida, because I was going to save her. Again, that came out. I was going to save her. And I did, actually. And she had multiple surgeries. But when I'd go have a drink, and I would get away and have one, I would cry and pull further away from people. Because now I had proof that there was some evil thing wrong with me, because my child was born with her spinal cord outside of her back. And there was something so rotten and wrong with me that I hope nobody would notice me ever again. And I could just take care of her. If I could take care of her, it would save me. I didn't have a lot of, it isn't that my mother wasn't a God person. She was, because she prayed. She said the rosary. She's very quiet about it. Nobody forced any of that on me. I had to go to church and religious ed, but I used to skip it and hang out with my friends and my dog. So it wasn't like fire and brimstone thing. I can't remember anybody forcing me to do anything. I just remember seeing my mother say the rosary beads. You know, I remember that. But other than that, I don't remember too much of it. So it couldn't have made too much of an impression on me. And that carried with me through life. I didn't. Once my daughter was born, and people were telling me about praying, it burnt me. I just couldn't stand it. And what I would do, I wouldn't be confrontational with you. I would make you disappear. I would get away from you because you were saying things that hurt me. Because I already felt like I caused it. So when you talked about that, I felt like, well, if there was a God, that God was punishing me and her. So what kind of a God is that? And I was like that for a long time. And then I don't know, later in life, I only had a couple of friends that were allowed in the house, according to him. And one of them happened to be some kind of Catholic charismatic, and she was really nice. But she'd come over and we'd drink wine together, so I didn't mind. And sometimes she'd bring me with her, and she'd have me bring my daughter, and they'd all say these prayers over as if, I don't know what they thought, she was going to regrow a spine, or I don't know what, but I went along with it. It was just like the 60s to me. It was just a magical mystery tour. Go, let's go see what happens. I never took any of it seriously. And none of it worked anyways. And what happened was year after year, I just felt worse and worse about myself. If I could have successfully killed myself, I would not be here to tell this story. And I tried. I would, of course, somebody sooner or later would bring me to sit in front of a psychiatrist because I didn't function. I wasn't functioning outside of taking care of the kids, and I barely took care of them. And I don't know. They didn't know what to do with me either. And the thing was, they didn't know that I drank because I didn't show up there drunk. And I couldn't come out of the house anyway. So most of the time they had to come to my house to see me because today they would never put up with this domestic abuse. But back then they did. Even if you called the police, they'd come and take him out, take him for a ride. Then they'd come back and they'd lecture me and tell me I need to be a nice wife now and cook him something to eat. And he's not going to cause any more trouble that they talk to him. And he would be laughing and drunk. And, you know, it was just disgusting. Anyways, nothing changed except that I got sicker. And I look back at it and I think, had I been able to get the help that I've had since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have been able to get out of there. I just couldn't keep my wits about me. It's not an excuse. I really couldn't. In 1985, when I got sober, during that year, I didn't even know whether I bought the groceries or not. I could swear I bought them because I was thinking of buying them. So it seemed to me that I bought them. And at this point in time, I was drinking wine around the clock and I had wine sores all over me. And I thought those was because maybe I got a venereal disease because men could do whatever they wanted with me. I couldn't have stopped them if I wanted to stop them. I was too inebriated. I was like a flubby fish laying on the pier, gasping for air. And I'm not proud of any of this. It is where it took me. And how did everybody survive through it? I'll tell you how. My oldest boy, who at the time was between 12 and 17 years old, was taking care of us. Because I would say to him, could you just cook for mom tonight, please? And he would feel so bad for me, he'd cook for me. My kids were probably more affected by me because I was a depressive than if I had been an abuser, because they couldn't even be angry with me. All they could do was feel sorry for me. And they always felt bad for me. So they covered up for me. I would bring them to therapy, not because I wanted to, because the therapist want me to bring them in. And because I would now and again end up in front of a psychiatrist who would make me have all these things. And I bring them and I'd say to them, I want you guys to be okay. And I mean it from my total heart. I meant it. And I'd say, just tell them whatever you need to. I'll do whatever I have to do so you guys will be okay. And the minute they would start to talk, I'd sit there and cry. I'm not kidding. I'd bawl. And they just clam up and stop talking. I'm not proud of this, but I am definitely one of the mothers that people end up going to. Adult children of alcoholics, or to Al-Anon if they're lucky, to get their life back in order. And that's how it was. And so in 1985, I don't know, I'll back up just a little and say in 1982, I think it was, I got it in my head that if I went to this thing called Overeaters Anonymous, I could get skinny. And I was already thin, by the way. I might have had a little bit of a swollen belly from my pancreas being swollen from booze and my liver. But if I went there, and I learned how to not eat, then I'd get a better husband. I could get rid of him and I'd be able to get out there. And if I looked right, I'd be right. I also went back to school at this time. And I was excelling on tests because I always excelled on tests. I could literally sit and listen to a lecture and ace the test. And he would burn my books and beat me up for leaving the house and going there. But somehow I did those things. And I didn't graduate, though, because he didn't let me go to graduation that day. So I didn't get to do that. But I did later on. Once I got sober, I went back and took a couple of courses and was able to graduate in 1990. But in 1983, I went back. I went to this thing called OA. And I got a sponsor who happened to be an alcoholic. She was in AA and OA. And she would tell me to go to AA meetings, but I thought she wanted me to go there to meet a sober guy. Because I was drinking. They didn't know I was drinking. Well, she did. She said she knew it, but nobody, I don't remember it. Let's put it that way. So I don't remember her talking to me about it, but she swears she did. So maybe she did. But I thought in my head that that's why they wanted me to go. And I never went to an AA meeting. I went to the AA dances so I could find a sober guy and my life would get better. I'm going to get thin. This is my new plan. I'm going to get a sober guy. I'm going to go to school. And they weren't bad ideas. It's just that I was drinking, so I was never going to get to do any of this anyhow. And I couldn't hear anything or hold on to anything that I heard. So one day, I went to this woman again and sat down next to her at the meeting. And she had me come to her house. And she 12-stepped me. And she was very firm. She said, you are... I have been telling you for years you're an alcoholic. I'm not doing this with you anymore. You are dying. Look at you. You don't even put food in your body because you're drinking. And if you don't go to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm coming to your house and I'm bringing you there. And I thought that would be terrible. Somebody come to my house and drag me out of the house and bring me to an AA meeting. That would be horrible. I can't do that. So I said, I'll go. I'll go. Don't worry about it. You don't need to come to my house. I'll go to the damn meeting and I'll let you know I went to the meeting. So I was kind of confused as to whether you could go to the meeting and still be drinking. So I white knuckled it that night. And it was hard because I was like having heebie-jeebies and everything, but I didn't want to walk. I wasn't completely sober because, of course, I had so much booze in me, but I wasn't drinking when I went in there to the meeting. And I sat down in the chair and I was a complete lost mess. I was a complete mess. And these old timers saw it and they saw that I couldn't put food in my body. It was, you'd see me. I was a street person, really. That's what I was. And it was easy to tell how sick I was and see how close to death I was. I was the only one that couldn't see it. And I sat there in that meeting and I don't know, like they were nice to me. Somebody got me a half a cup of coffee and it was so great that I didn't have to spill it and make a fool out of myself. And I thought that was nice of them. And I didn't have anybody being nice to me because I lived in abuse at home. So that kindness fed me. And I went back again for it because somehow I felt safe there. And I thought, I don't think I can be like these people. I really don't think I can be like them. But I liked being around them. And I knew I'd never be happy like them. They were laughing and telling jokes. And I did my usual thing. I sat to the back of it or I sat in a seat far away from everybody and just kind of watched them. And this old timer drew me in and he asked me if I'd sit next to him. And I did. And he said, you know what? I got a half a sandwich here. I got a sandwich and I can only eat half it. I tell my wife all the time, please don't make me a whole sandwich. Would you help me out and eat half this sandwich? And you know what he did? He took the pride of the alcoholic away from me because being ashamed is the other side of the coin of pride. It's pride in reverse. I was the lowest there could be on the planet. And he was asking me to eat part of a sandwich and he wasn't trying to make me eat a whole sandwich. And somehow I felt like it would be all right to try to eat food around him. So I would. And then I'd start going, hoping he was going to have a half a sandwich for me. And other times he'd come in, he'd have little chocolate candy kisses. And he'd pass one over to me. And I could put the chocolate in my mouth. And it felt so good. And I learned that that would help me. And I began detoxing without knowing I was detoxing. Now, these people were trying to get me a bed in the detox. And they could get a bed, but they couldn't find anywhere for my daughter to go. They needed to have her be secure and they couldn't find anywhere for her. So they end up walking me home, coming in my house, hanging with me longer. One old timer after another would take me. And I didn't even see what they were doing. I didn't even notice it. They were there. Like other things that happened in life, like I didn't know how they happened. They were just there. And I didn't hear much of what they were saying in the meeting yet. It took me about 6 months to actually remember one sentence anybody would say. And I would walk out of there talking to myself, trying to remember what it was I heard. But they were nice little things. I remembered the little things like, easy does it would stick in my head. They used a lot of slogans back then. And I'd say, easy does it all the way home. Or they'd say, don't drink, think. And I'd say, don't drink, think. What am I going to think about? I don't know. Don't drink, think. You don't have to drink even if you want to drink. I keep saying that to myself. I don't have to drink even if I want to drink. Well, what am I going to do? I asked them one day. Because I don't know how to not drink. And that was my first day in. That wasn't the first day I was at AA. That was the first day I tuned in to what I was doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was asking them, well, what am I supposed to do? I think about drinking all the time. I wake up and I don't know if I drank or I didn't drink. And I feel like I did drink, but I don't think I left my bed. And it seemed like I was drinking. And they'd talk about drunk dreams. And I'd say, oh, that's what that was. So now they really had my attention because they were telling me about me. And they were just talking about them. And I'd say, oh, that's what that was. I didn't really want to have what you had. And I would fight it. And they'd say, that's because I still wanted to drink. And I'd say, yeah, well, that's true. I was thinking of drinking all through the meeting. So you got me there. And it was kind of like that where I'd have to go, yeah, well, you got me there. That's true. And then one day they had me sit up the front of the room and do what I'm doing now. And I cried the whole time. I couldn't even tell my story because everything I thought of made me cry. And somebody got me a coffee and they said it was okay and that I did a great job and they all clapped for me. I didn't even know what they were clapping for, but I felt like I belonged in that room. And that room became as important to me as the bar room came to me. I needed to be there. And I wish they had that meeting 24/7 because I didn't want to have to go back home because I didn't know what I would do. I had to walk past package stores that were talking to me and people would offer me a ride and I wouldn't get in the car with them. I was so afraid. I was so afraid. I didn't know what people would do with me, what they wanted. It took me a long time, about 3 years before I could really relax enough to let somebody give me a ride, get in the car with them. And I cried because nothing bad happened. And I learned how to take care of the kids because women and men in AA let me know it was okay, that I didn't have to be perfect. All I had to do was be sober. And that if I didn't know how to make something, somebody would come over the house and they'd make up some meals. And little by slow, I began to start to participate in my own life. And it was that feeling that kept me coming, that they were showing me that I could think and I could put my life back together. And I think that's why, even to this day, I don't have to rely on some kind of power outside of myself, because I had so been broken that they had to teach me how to do things for myself. And that's the power that I connected with, was the power inside of me. I just had to do little things, little tiny things, little steps. And those things became big things to me. And when I had things to do that seemed way too big for me, they would come with me. It wasn't always the same people, but they'd come with me. One of my kids ended up in a unit for adolescents, because once you start getting sober and you start doing business with people and they get a real look at how you're living, well, there's consequences. And society expects you to be able to perform as if you're not an alcoholic, when you are an alcoholic, but you're not drinking now. So now everybody comes in and gets in the mix and they do this and that. So they put my oldest kid in a teenage rehab kind of thing, only it was for mental health things, oppositional disorder, I guess they called it. But it was really me that was the opposition, and they made me come in to see the psychiatrist more than they made him. And if I didn't go to AA and I didn't show up sober, they wouldn't let me see him. So it was more about me than it was about him. And it was a good thing they did that, because he learned how he got through school. He learned how to make a life for himself. And he didn't have to take care of mom and the other kids anymore. And I'm sad that it had to happen that way, but that's what happened. And that's the story of my life and where booze took me. There is nothing left in a drink for me, but I'm a real alcoholic. And what I mean by that is there's something really wrong with this. And just because I'm sober 36 years and I've put a life together I wouldn't trade with anybody. And it has nothing to do with anything. I got really not much to show for it. in material things, but I have got relationships that are second to none with my children, my grandchildren, my friends, my AA connections. If I had 20 years to sit here and tell you every single person that ever helped me in AA, I wouldn't have enough time. And I'm not exaggerating. Just the people that pass me from one person to the next person, stand in a parking lot with me, got me to eat, took me to food, gave me. Later in life, I've had vacations because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Amazing things. People needed someone to watch their house up in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. And it was on a ledge, and it was the most beautiful house you ever saw. And I got to go there and take care of their plants and take care of their house while they were away. That was amazing. And I got to take care of little preemie infants that were born because the young mother, one of the daughters of one of the alcoholic old timers that got me sober, her husband had to go to the police academy. And she needed someone to help her with the preemies. And I love children and babies. And I got to go there and help her with those preemies. I mean, I've had experiences that I would not trade for anything in the world. And I never forget where I came from, because I could in a heartbeat think my daughter laying in a bed for 5 years was a problem worthy of a drink. And for me, having a good time and having fun also made me think I should have a drink. And I need to remember, wait a minute here. You got the chronic mind of the alcoholic. You are not going to have a good time if you pick up a drink. That is not what's going to happen to you. And you know it. So best you stay away from that. Some people can be bartenders. Some people can have alcohol in their home. I don't have any of that in my home, and I don't go anywhere near it, because I know where it took me, and I know how easy it would be for me to say, fuck it, I'm out of here. See, because I was a fuck it, I'm out of here drinker. And we're not all the same. And your story might be completely different than mine, but we ended up in the same place needing somebody. Somebody said it today. I love it. I see if I can say it right. I alone am the one that can do something about my problem, but I can't take care of my problem alone. I need to have people to help me. And some people need to have a higher power they got to make it into something, because they can't say they need themselves, but I do need myself. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave me back me. And I'm wicked grateful to have that. Thank you for letting me remember when. I hope I didn't go on too long, but I got to get this out, and that was great. Thank you.